This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink, inspiring public curiosity about food. Learn more at mofad.org.
This week on Meatin' 3, we bring you stories about the coldest, darkest season. We start in a California vineyard.
It's cold, but it's wet, and things are still alive. There's a lot of life in this soil.
We explore two frontiers of cocktail culture: luxury ice and the rise of non-alcoholic drinks.
The rocks traditionally becomes 25% of your drink's volume, and as such, it imparts smells and tastes.
And we investigate the risks facing New York City delivery workers during the harsh winter.
In the wintertime, after 2 hours of biking, it's quite easy actually for the bikes to sing upside down or slip or slide.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meatin' 3, that's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, for some food for thought to sustain you through the dead of winter. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, and welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. And on today's episode, if you live in the neighborhood, you already know Buttermilk Channel and their famous brunches. In that time, Beyoncé and Jay-Z celebrated New Year's Eve there. Well, Doug Kroll and Ryan Angulo opened French Louis, their follow-up Brooklyn-based bistro, as a place to further celebrate these hordes of happy customers willing to cross that river. That's because no matter where you are, where you come from, or what you're in for, they serve kindness and salt, which is the eponymous name of their book, as well as their overall ethos behind keeping eaters happy. And, you know, sticky buns and buttermilk fried chicken don't hurt either. Welcome to the show, Ryan and Doug. So it's very funny. I live almost directly in between your two restaurants. And they're not poles because they're not very different. But they also aren't quite alike. Open 5 years apart, Buttermilk Channel sits what was a sleepier neighborhood of Carroll Gardens, and French Louis is on Atlantic Avenue, a major thoroughfare of Brooklyn. How do you consider them? If you were to anthropomorphically, you know, make them your children, I'm sure they already are, how would you describe those two restaurants?
Which one's the stepchild?
Well, Buttermilk Channel is the halfwit, the village idiot. No, I mean, I think of both of them as bistros, which is a term. No, okay, let's scratch that. I think of both of them as bistros, which is a term that doesn't necessarily mean that much. It sort of gets thrown around in a generic way, but to me means, you know, a restaurant that is sort of the hub of its community that. That is a place where you can come three times a week and have three different experiences. It has a big menu. You know, it's got to have a steak. It's probably got to have oysters. A French bistro is a place that, you know, if you're in Paris, serves sort of food from all the different regions around France, and country food, you know, sort of simple food, but in a definitely an urban setting. And
see, I wondered if it's not derogatory, but I wonder if bistro is a bad term because it feels to me that you have to satisfy everybody. And you can't be a niche restaurant that serves a singular thing.
It's a lousy term, but to me, the quintessential ideal bistro is something that means means something to us. And it's what we wanted with French Louis. And also, I mean, with Buttermilk Channel to start and then French Louis ultimately.
But that's not really a bad thing because we like to appeal to a lot of different people.
Yeah.
We like to be all occasion, whatever you want to make of it.
Yeah.
It's not really a niche restaurant.
Yeah.
I feel like we've won when we have a couple that comes in with their kids and they have a little family dinner and it's super messy and there's stuff all over the ground and they're feeding their kids fried chicken bits. And then they come back the next night or the next week for an anniversary dinner.
Yeah. No, I love that. And I love the diversity that you get in there and also that swath of demographic. Because you're not just neighborhood restaurants anymore. You know, everyone hopes to embrace the locals so you have that constant customership. But people are making both of your restaurants destinations.
They kind of got to because we're in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
I mean, as you know, if you're in a super dense Manhattan neighborhood, you could serve a very niche thing.
Yeah.
You know, we need to have something on the menu for everyone. Especially Buttermilk Channel is truly the edge of nowhere. I mean, if you walk three blocks, two blocks in any of three directions, there's like scrap metal yards and like, you know, like fields of dump trucks. It's the end.
Or where I have to pick up my mail if I don't receive it.
Yeah, right. Exactly. But where French Louis is a lot more central, but still Brooklyn.
Let's talk about the story of the name behind both restaurants, because I think they defined the character and culture of them so well. Buttermilk Channel is, or was?
Buttermilk Channel is and was the body of water that's in between Brooklyn and Governor's Island. So if you walk to the water from where we are, which most people don't often these days, that's Buttermilk Channel, which I feel really fortunate every day that we located a restaurant next to such a delicious sounding body of water, because it makes for a great story. Yeah. And I think you need a story when you open a restaurant, because when you have a new place, it doesn't have a soul, it doesn't have a story, and it's great to have a story to tell. And also, buttermilk sounds yummy. Buttermilk's sort of universally appealing. Mm-hmm. It sounds good.
Well, it's not only just the name of that channel. The story that's told about that channel is that the currents were so violent it churns
the milk into butter. Yeah.
Yeah. Is that a recipe in the book that you actually agitate a cow in a large body of water?
That's the other recipe for buttermilk.
It should be. It should be.
And then French Louis.
That came out of a lot of trial and error, because we had a name at first. We're going to call it Concord. Like the plane.
Oh, I remember, yeah.
And then we were like, there's still like mail that comes that has that shit on it. But but then we thought we might get sued. Someone advised us that like, this is not a good idea. You know, you're going to open with all this stuff, business cards and everything else, and then you're going to have to change the name, which would have been a real bummer. So then we just like, I mean, we had people making lists. Everyone we knew was like contributing a name. Our bookkeeper, remember Andrew, came up with like this huge list of like all these names, everything you could think of. And I don't really know.
Louis came in my head. It's hard to name a French restaurant because you want to give it a French name that people can pronounce. Louis, I realized I've got two Louis grandparents. My mother's from St. Louis. Her middle name's Louise. Like, okay, that's good. And then I looked up FrenchLouis.com, because I thought maybe that would be a cuter website address. And it takes me to, instead, the website of this character, who's this sort of folk hero from up in the Adirondacks, who, you know, is like a great American story, built the Erie Canal and was a lumberjack and ultimately kind of a legendary, like, happy hermit character. A very well-documented, fortunately for us, hermit.
Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of hit all the marks. I mean, Doug really wanted, like, he really wanted a character to identify the place. Like, it was like a rabbit for a while named Pierre or something like that, if I remember correctly. So it kind of like, oh, we just kind of like happened upon this man that actually exists. And there it is.
So you happened upon this channel, which was so strong it agitated cows, and you happened upon this French-Canadian Adirondacks piece of folklore. How do you become part of this story? Like, how do you establish Buttermilk Channel and French Louis as modern day folklore in Brooklyn? Because I think you have.
Like French Louis the person?
No, French Louis the restaurant. Huh. Because I can mention Buttermilk Channel to someone that lives in California and they know it.
Yeah, they're small towns, or the neighborhoods where our restaurants are, and it's amazing how deep we get in people's lives. I mean, Buttermilk's been 10 years, French Louis now is 5 years. And it's a lot. 10 years is a significant chunk of time in people's lives. You know, you see people who were just dating, who now have been married, who now have one kid, who have two kids. We just see it, and our staff tends to stick around for a long time, and they, you know, we're not, our service is very kindness oriented, so you know, it's not formal. We can all become friends, and we just have a deep relationship with the neighborhood, and that's it.
I mean, Ryan, you and I first met when you were working at Stanton Social, a place that, what, churned out 1,500 plates a night?
Yeah, it was all small plates. It was probably more than that.
It's a very different atmosphere walking into Buttermilk Channel for many reasons. It's not subterranean for you.
Yeah, there was the basement.
It's a light, bright room, warm, inviting, neighborhoody, in air quotes. How conceptually do you create an environment that everyone feels so welcome?
I think just, I mean, making the food approachable, and just like that way people can like look at the menu and kind of relax, like, oh, this is familiar, oh, I know I can find something like there's always something on one of the menus that anyone can have. Like at Buttermilk, there's always like a burger, and you know, fried chicken is pretty and duck meatloaf, like that's pretty recognizable. And then at French Louis, it's like oh, I don't know what to get. Steak frites. You know what I mean? That's like a whole section for you. If like everything seems just a little too weird, maybe that's what you have on your first try at French Louis. And then maybe the next time you go, you branch out to something else.
I mean, not to knock Stanton Social, because I loved it. And it was so ahead of the curve. But the comfort was that you knew an element.
Like French onion soup dumplings.
Yeah, but the dish as a whole wasn't.
Didn't resonate. Yeah, and it was very specifically plated and it was all small plates.
Yeah.
Which is great. I liked working there. I mean, I was there for like 3 years, but I definitely wanted that change at that point to like something more homey. I remember saying to one of the owners when he asked me why I was leaving, I was like, I haven't really made soup in like 3 years. Like, just, you know what I mean? Like, you just want to make like soup and serve it to someone. Like,
because you couldn't know what you mean at all. But yes, no, I kind of know what you mean.
Well, you couldn't do that there. Like, you would always have to like take a dish that you were thinking of and put it into that format.
Yeah.
So if you like, even like, I did a version of the chicken and waffles there, but I had to make it shareable, so it was very different than the one at Buttermilk.
What was the first soup that you two shared, or who courted who? How did this collaboration start?
I didn't have a chef for this restaurant I was planning, so I took out a Craigslist ad, and that's how you meet anyone. That's how everyone.
Did you ask? Do you know how to make soup?
Yeah, I said. Yeah. I said, hey, would you be interested in making soup? We had an interview that went pretty well, and then Ryan had me over to his tiny little apartment in Astoria, and him and his wife put together like a, you know, however many 8 courses, like little tasting thing that was, first of all, really, really wonderful, like really simple, delicious, you know, wonderful food, but also I was so impressed with the hospitality of it. I mean, the two of them had like 8 dishes or 4, like between them, and they were like hustling around, his wife is washing dishes, and like just the level of hospitality there, because hospitality is like not just a front of house thing. That's like, that was really nice.
Mm-hmm.
And Ryan was interested in, I thought the neighborhood could use a bistro, you know, as I said, sort of a place that could be like the hub of its community. And Ryan was interested in doing that too.
Yeah. You came from working at Blue Water Grill, which, like Stanton Social, the volume, the numbers alone are just astronomical. Compared to, well, I mean, you guys are doing very well for yourselves now.
It just closed.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, so, oh, so
yeah.
Did Stan.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so does Stan Social.
Which is wild.
Yeah, Blue Water was like, it's like being in like a train station. It was just people just pouring through there, and you didn't really have a lot of personal relationships.
So do you have to pair things back to make them feel comfortable? Do you have to pair menus and have people deal with less volume for it to have some sense of hospitality? How do you adjust going from such a big box into these two amazing singular restaurants and make people warm again?
I mean, for us in the front of house, it's really about kindness. Like it says on the cover of the book. I mean, our hospitality is pretty simple. It's like, it's really basic niceness and compassion. You know, seeing someone come to the door and having a feeling for what that person wants and believing that it's important. We were just, as we were sitting here having pizza, talking about restaurants that will remain nameless where we've been recently, where people were really mean to us. You know, I think everyone, including me, walks into a restaurant for the first time in New York City, and it's like intimidating, and you're like, you feel insecure, and you're like, how are they going to reject me? What are they going to tell me? Some you know, really pretty looking person's going to walk up to me and tell me that it's a 3-hour waiter, that I just can't be there. It can be, you know, we strive to do the opposite. Yeah. We want to welcome you in every way and make you feel comfortable and identify ways that we can give you a better time. And it extends to the kitchen as well.
You have a phrase, an idiom that you ask people to say at the door to greet people? And in that, how do you parlay that into working a table?
They smile. They got a smile. I mean, it's like I always tell people when I'm interviewing them that we like may all know people and love people who are like shy and weird and awkward and like come off as mean and you love them anyway. But like that's not the kind we need. I need a big smile personality. And you really just have to care about someone having a good time. If you don't, then like you're not going to be able to do it. You can't fake it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that goes to say with food as well.
Well, from the kitchen perspective, it's like a lot of chefs think that it's easier just to say no when someone has a request or something like that. But it's so much easier to just say yes. You know, you want your steak without salt, you know, like not at all the way I'm preparing it, with just like a side of greens and that's it. It's like, of course you can have it that way. You know what I mean? It's just like, I mean, there's certain specials that you'll make that you really want it to be the way, you know, you made seven of them, you know, and you just want it to be like that thing. You'll say, okay, there's no modifications on this one tonight. But like, it's so much easier to just like, just to say yes to people.
I mean, what are the limits of allowances you've allowed people to have? What are the weirdest orders? And did you bend over backwards for, you know, Beyonce and Jay-Z, or did they want exactly what was on menu?
They wanted what was on the menu. That was New Year's Eve. But Beyonce has come in before for brunch, I think with her sister, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she was just like, I want chicken wings. And we don't have chicken wings. And my sous chef, Andrew Pease, was downstairs, pulled out a case of chicken, cut all the wings off, and made her chicken wings. So we had a bunch of wingless birds for a couple services.
That wouldn't be a problem anymore. She would have a bean stew.
Yeah.
She's vegan now.
Oh, she's vegan now.
Yeah.
But yeah, things that are physically possible, we like to do. I mean, and brunch. You know, everyone's saying no at brunch. Like, we do not. But on the channel, we'll do all sorts of wacky stuff.
I've always told people the brunch menu is just a list of suggestions. And you hope that most people take those suggestions. That's all it is.
Excellent. When I come in and ask for the weirdest iterated dish and you guys still say yes, I know that you're being honest today.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're used to it. I have brunch is breakfast, and breakfast is like, I don't know, you're half awake. You've maybe sort of regressed into sort of a childhood place. I don't know. You just want what you want.
Yeah. Well, I want to be at Buttermilk Channel or French Louis right now. Why we ever came all the way to the studio where we could have just stayed in the hood, I don't know. But on that, we're going to take a quick break. You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. Featuring a variety of interactive displays, MOFAD encourages eaters of all ages to be curious about food. The museum currently operates MOFAD Lab, a 5,000-square-foot experimental space in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where Chow, making the Chinese-American restaurant, is currently on show until the end of March 2019. This exhibition celebrates the birth and evolution of Chinese-American restaurants, tracing their nearly 170-year history, and sparking conversations about food culture, immigration, and what it means to be American. It highlights the evolution timeline of Chinese-American restaurant menus, dating back to 1910, and also highlights a tasting section where participants get to enjoy tastings created by the country's most talented chefs who specialize in Chinese-American cuisine. Make sure you check out Chow while you still can. The exhibition closes at the end of March 2019. Check out MOFAD's tastings and extensive event calendar at mofad.org/events.
Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Doug and Ryan of Buttermilk Channel and French Louis. And we have to talk about the food. I mean, that, of course, is such a large draw of these two restaurants, of all restaurants. And we can talk ad nauseum about the hospitality and kindness.
I'm already nauseated.
because that is also foremost. The way you've cultivated such an inviting atmosphere. But then when you sit down and you have delicious food, there's no leaving. I mean, the retention of customers that come there must be so super high. What are your dishes? Like, what do you crave at either restaurants? And what are the best sellers and why?
Well, the best sellers at Buttermilk are fried chicken, right? Still, to this day.
Yeah, chicken and waffles and a brunch. I don't know, fried pork chop. What do you eat for dinner, though? What do you eat for dinner at French Louis?
French Louis? Oh, my go-to is steak tartare and fried anchovies together.
Yeah. Ooh, I haven't done that. That's a strong move.
Although the other night, I did snails, and we have this new, like, tuna, grilled tuna kind of appetizer in the Lemire section. I did that one. That was a good combination. And I mainly ate the snails because we use this small farm out of Peconic, and Peconic escargot, and people aren't used to those snails. They're like minerally and just very vegetal, And someone had complained about him. I was like, "Well, I'm going to eat some snails tonight." And I'm like, "These are delicious." Like, yeah. I don't know what they're talking about.
I am a sucker for small fish, but you guys had me at that pecan pie sundae, and it's named after you. It's Doug's Pecan Pie Sundae, correct?
Yeah, we open right before Thanksgiving, like 2 days before Thanksgiving. So pecan pie was sort of on our brains, and I don't know. You had that idea. You had an idea to do a pecan pie sundae, right?
Yes.
I remember you asking me 2 days or the day before we opened, like, are you going to give me your pecan pie recipe? Because I do always make that at home for my family, and I'm sort of the only one who's eating it. But now I probably said, I don't know, just make a pecan pie. Just make sure it has molasses in it. But we were going to do that as a seasonal sort of thing, but then it's like, that was just a hit. Yeah, there's no need to ever take that off the menu.
Yeah. Because the first time I actually came into Buttermilk Channel is when I photographed the New Brooklyn Cookbook. And I believe you guys were the last restaurant that... the writers accepted in that book. It was about 31 restaurants and makers. And, they wanted you in that book, I think, solely based on the buttermilk chicken and that pecan pie. And I photographed it. I had it. And I've never forgotten it.
There you go.
I have it all the time.
Yeah.
A little taste. Not the whole thing.
Whereas that restaurant has so many familiar things, or at least to most people. French Louis does this great job of introducing, well, I know it's classic French cuisine, but new things to the menu. Mm. And I've also become so smitten with the soakas that you do.
We've
emailed multiple times about it. We make it at home all the time. Do you feel like you have a lot more liberty to play at French Louis because it's French-American versus what Buttermilk Channel is?
I can kind of go off. You know, I could throw some Japanese on the menu if I wanted to, and it wouldn't seem that out of place. The menu at French Louis from the beginning, it just changes more often. People are more used to that kind of concept of, like, a lot of things, maybe just the setups and whatnot changing very often. Like, I change it. Like, of course, like, 30% of it never changes. Like, the steak frites stay the same, and there's a few kind of like things that have become signatures, like a couple salads and the snails and whatnot. But then there's other things that we just like take on and off, you know, all the time, just depending on the day and what's available and whatnot.
I mean, never take off the lamb French dip. It's a favorite of mine.
Yeah, I know.
And you still do the trout po' boy too.
Yeah, lunch and brunch I don't change too much because it doesn't really. It doesn't need to be. And I feel like people that come in for lunch, they want that regularity. They want to know they can come and get their French dip or their chicken paillard. And, you know, if I change it, they're going to be like, why the hell did you change it?
Yeah. Well, now you screwed yourself, too, by writing a book because people are going to cook things at home, compare it to what they have in the restaurant, and there's going to have this wanted need for ultimate consistency.
Mm.
How do you pleasure somebody by being consistent, being that rock? Let's take it from a salt standpoint, actually, because you have techniques on how you salt in the book. What methodologies should people always be using for salt, and what should they expect at both restaurants on a salt level?
Oh, that it's going to be seasoned to, like, you know, to a degree that you might not be used to. Like, why does this taste different at a restaurant and not at home? Because at home, you're like, oh, that might be too much salt. Or you might think it's too much salt. But at the restaurant, I mean, we season very liberally. You know, it's just like any restaurant, probably. But it's seasoned till it tastes, you know, the way that we want it, till it tastes, like, really, really great. And you might be a little shy with the salt shaker or seasoning at home, just because it looks like a lot, when in actuality it's not. I mean, if you like seasoned a bunch of steaks, like 10 steaks, if you actually like pour that into a measuring spoon or something, it would probably be like a teaspoon at the end of the day, you know. Yeah. But it looks like a lot when you're doing it.
But I've always loved blanch your water to make it taste like the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that does seem intense, but you also roast vegetables on top of blankets of salt. With that, you also promote big flavors in the French, you know, scope of things. And I haven't seen a cookbook in a while that I read and read terms like aioli, hollandaise, bordelaise, béarnaise, pea stew, and not think of it as a French cookbook. I thought of it as a neighborhood cookbook. I thought of it as a Brooklyn cookbook.
We tried to throw around French too much, but certain they really nail certain things sound better in French.
Yeah.
And they've had some really good ideas. I mean, aioli is central to cuisine Angulo.
And what else are you going to call hollandaise? I mean, hollandaise is just holland. Like, there's no other word for it.
Yeah. It's a really good idea, too. I love hollandaise.
Yeah. Call it hot butter mayonnaise. I mean, I don't know.
I mean, sounds delicious. But, I mean, how has the lexicon changed since you've opened up buttermilk to French Louis in how people read a menu or interpret food or have expectations of your restaurants?
I think the education on food just gets more, you know, people are just more willing to try stuff every year. I mean, it's just, we're so saturated with, like, this food knowledge now. Food Network and Cooking Channel and shows like this. I mean, 10 years ago, they were there, but there's even more now. Like, I mean, as many as you want, pretty much. And people's interest in food, it's just been become one of those things where, like, people are just so into experiences now. Like, they want to eat it, they want to take a picture of it, they want to talk about it. You know, write a post about it. You know, it's like the whole thing.
I think like a critical mass of French restaurants sort of like broke through people's prejudice about French food too. There was an idea coming out of the 70s and 80s that French food was really fussy and basically not what you wanted to eat. Or it was this really rich, crazy thing that was also therefore not something you would want frequently. And I don't know, there's been a lot of French restaurants in the last 10 years in New York City that I think finally pushed people. It's still not like, Italian food, I think, is like the most well-liked food there is.
Also, taking French out of French cuisine, meaning that you're not serving Dover sole, you're going to local sources. And I love that you highlight not only Rhode Island, because Ryan, you were from there, but Sheepshead Bay here in Brooklyn, and using these, you know, great waters to be able to pull from. Snug Harbor, too, in Staten Island for its greens. I mean, I only drive through Staten Island, and I know how beautiful Snug Harbor is, but what are these places, kind of like Buttermilk Channel was, maybe that thoroughfare of Atlantic Ave, these overseen areas of artisans and products and expertise that you utilize in these restaurants that you think need to be highlighted?
Well, Snug Harbor, that's like a personal relationship that I have with John Wilson, who's like the head farmer there. Because they're very small production. I mean, sometimes he'll call me up and be like, he called me up a couple of weeks ago and was like, your whole order froze. I don't have it. And it's like, okay. You know, and that's just what happens with a small, I think they've only got like 4 acres or something. It might even be smaller than that. So it's very small production. And so we try to work it in, you know, as much as we can. But I mean, that's with any small, like really small, like micro producer like that. But we wanted to highlight it in the book because it's just like a cool relationship and his produce is awesome. I mean, I think he sells to like Per Se now and places like that, you know? So it's a...
And that's a real farm that's like planted, as Sean pointed out, like in the ground of New York City.
Yeah.
Can't do anywhere else. All the ground of New York City is poison one way or another.
Yeah.
But there, that place, because of its history, is clean.
Yeah, it's pretty pristine. And being the harbor that it is, and it has a whole bunch of wooden ships in that area too. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so well preserved and so bountiful. And, you know, Staten Island gets a bad rap, especially with new television shows kind of aiming to do so.
Yeah.
But it's really got so much great produce coming out of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's cool. I mean, and hopefully, like, people barely remember that the Staten Island dump used to be, like, a thing. Like, you can see it from space. That was, like, a thing for years. But now it's becoming, they're going to turn into, like, a beautiful park. And, like, that land will probably become pretty fertile, you know. Maybe in another generation. Well, but
let's talk about Sheepshead Bay in the same vein. What's so special about that body of water?
Well, it's just like, you know, it's been a fishing community forever.
In the city, we're a little bit out of touch with the stuff that's so close to us, specifically our waterways. I mean, the Buttermilk Channel neighborhood, like, was founded around its harbor, but you're not really aware of there being a harbor there now. And Sheepshead Bay is right there. Yeah. And all these wonderful fish are in the waters right there and around and in Long Island.
Yeah, Doug and I went fishing one day off of Sheepshead Bay, and it was during striped bass season. And we brought back like 8 beautiful, gigantic bass. It was right when French Louis opened, because our electrician was took us. We split up the fish between both restaurants and had this beautiful fish for like all these specials for a few days. And that's what's in Sheepshead Bay, you know, like... beautiful, fresh, pristine fish.
People don't think of that. This part of the world when Europeans first arrived here, and it was just so dense with wildlife. You know, the air is just like thick with ducks, and there were cod. You could just pull them out of the water, and oysters everywhere. And we ate most of that and sent it to other places. But there's still so much. I mean, there's still so much in the ocean.
Yeah. And aside from the ocean, some of the land animals that you just mentioned, I feel like both of your restaurants really highlight the breadth of what is here and what can be done. You're not singular in the sense that you're not just a fried chicken restaurant at Buttermilk, though you could be if you ever wanted to be. And you're not just a steak frites restaurant at French Louis. How do you define yourselves past that, you know, one bastion of why people come there?
I don't know.
I mean, different things to different people. There's always like, there's for someone who comes in like, always wants to know what's new. There's people who only get one thing over and over again forever. You know, there's one of our best customers who every time he comes tells us how he'll never get the fried chicken.
He just abstains.
I would never get that. That's boring. I would never get that. This is why, you know, it's good to have a, we have a huge menu.
It's massive.
Good menu. Yeah. Good menu. And it's about like taking the same pride in every item on the menu, whether it's your steak frites or your, you know, duck meatloaf or whatever it is. I think one of the best compliments I got from a customer, I can't remember who it was, but it was at Buttermilk. And she was like, this is my husband and I's favorite place for fish. And I was like, holy crap, that's awesome. You know, like, you know, I didn't really hear that very often.
Yeah. I mean, I think of that at sitting at the bar at French Louis. It's my favorite place for small, you know, small fish bites and having a cocktail or a glass of wine. I know you've opened up in Tokyo, too, and I kind of want to touch on that neighborhood. I mean, it's a big neighborhood, Harajuku, and it's far different than, you know, Carroll Gardens and Atlantic Avenue.
I guess it's like the opposite.
Yeah.
If a neighborhood could have an opposite.
Yeah. And it's a very fish-forward society. What do you serve there that is standard of both Buttermilk channels? And are there any Japanese iterations of your classic dishes?
There's not really any Japanese iterations yet. We'll see, I guess. But it's kind of like a greatest hits menu for that. It's like, you know,
it's
right?
More it's than
like,
greatest. It's almost a copy. I mean,
it's like, but it's like brunch. I mean, they serve brunch every day. That's one thing that's different.
They serve pancakes all the time. Pancakes are available at dinner because pancakes are the most popular
they
thing.
They are over
big,
there.
Yeah, big. Ours are weird. You know, are different for them. They're like, they call them traditional because they're not sweet. And they're like plain, you know. They're flavored with maple syrup, and you put maple syrup on them.
But like you can get that. Like there's some brunch items that you can get all day, and then there's like I don't know. There's like the duck meatloaf's there, chicken's there. It's the one version of the steak's there because there's been so like the steak changes seasonally at the one, you know, in Brooklyn. There, it's not so seasonal just yet. It's just a different kind of restaurant. The way it's run is different.
These dishes are pretty much, I mean, they're pretty much identical. They're like 30% smaller because people just eat smaller. Even with the smaller menu items, most people will share one entree. And just a few, most of the ingredients were all really great. Our potatoes were we had trouble finding a potato.
Yeah.
For French fries.
The French fries are kind of short, kind of mini French fries.
The crispy potato is a small potato.
It's a small potato, yeah. They don't have our big American potatoes.
It's better than soggy and long.
Yeah. So do you import American potatoes for that? Or how do you...
No, you know, I went to McDonald's just to see, and like their potatoes, their French fries suck. Interesting. No, they were different. It was like, this isn't the same.
So whereas the food changes, how does the hospitality change in Japan? I know there are so many different ideologies behind hospitality in Japanese restaurants. Did you study any of that?
I mean, there's so many different kinds of restaurants there, obviously, that have different styles of hospitality. One thing I particularly love there, and we don't think of ourselves as being, like, too inhibited here in New York, but, like, in a Tokyo restaurant, you can wave down your waiter. And that's not a bad thing. Where so often we sit, and, like, we're barely even looking up. We're just, like, sitting there hoping that someone will come our way. And it, like, really can make for an uncomfortable situation where you feel like you're being neglected. But there you can just wave, and it's not a problem. I appreciate that.
Are you asking people to do that to you at Buttermilk Channel? Is that okay?
No, we feel terrible. It's so cultural. If someone waves, you feel so bad. But if not, I had to remind myself there. It's not a problem.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other things you picked up from being in Japan and brought back to Buttermilk or French Louis and instituted in those restaurants?
Maybe we couldn't bring back, but like we loved how everyone washed dishes there.
Yeah, that was cool. There's no dishwasher. Like no designated, hired dishwasher. front of the house, back of the house, when there's dishes, they just, no one's doing anything, you go and do it.
I can see that.
I can't see that. Yeah, cool. I can't see that happening here.
I have a great imagination.
I mean, they do that. I saw that in Europe, too. I trailed at a few places in Ireland a long time ago. And, like, the hostess, when she was done seating people, she'd put on an apron and go in the back and do the dishes. That was her other job. And I was like, that's great.
I mean, you've already promoted the idea of those two restaurants or the communities you're in being familiar. You know, almost having customers feel like part of your family. So you could tell them to get up and wash. I mean, you could probably ask patrons
to
really
help out. We really do break down those barriers. Yeah. We have some very close relationships. People have stepped through to the other side.
Yeah, really? Who?
I just, you know. I mean, there's a story we tell in that book of, like, we've got this one girl, Lucy, who we keep. The staff got into making birthday cakes for her. And we're talking not the kitchen. This is, like, two waiters. And it just got to every year, you know, over, say, 4 years now, her cakes have gotten bigger and more elaborate. And two of them took, like, pastry lessons so they could, like, you know, make the unicorn cake for, you know, to blow. It's, like, it's kind of fun to go over the top for an eight-year-old, you know. Yeah. But, and she's been in the, she was in the kitchen helping with her cake.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And at 5 and 10 years old, I mean, you're an ingrained part of this community, this society now. Where do you see yourself in the next 5, 10 years? What do Buttermilk Channel and French Louis change? Are there more of those types of restaurants of yours on the horizon?
And hopefully they won't have to change too much. Yeah. I mean, I like them both the way they are now.
Robots.
More robots. Yeah. That's what I felt after watching the Super Bowl commercials. I'm like, wow, it's 75% robots now.
Was it? Like,
oh, yes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Not that I'm fearful, but yes.
Yeah, we can get really, really kind robots.
Yeah. Well, at least you've had one consistent throughout the years, and it is that kindness. And it is that salt, that level of consistency. In this changing day and age, do you find with labor laws, with, you know, food media, with... people's, you know, ever expansive knowledge of what's on their plate. Do you see those two main tenets ever changing?
No. Yeah, I don't see them changing.
It's a very old, it's sort of an old fashioned style of restaurant, certainly for New York City. It's one that you see less of for reasons that you're sort of hitting on, like the cost of labor and the cost of rent. We're seeing more getting pushed to the bottom and the top of the sort of chain where, like, we've got fast casual exploding where you're like just kind of ordering from a counter and you've got, you know, at the high end, a sort of very formal tasting menu experience. We have sort of an old fashioned style of restaurant where, you know, you're having a fine dining experience, but a very friendly and personal one.
Well, I mean, I'm a little old fashioned. I hope things never change and I hope always to live in between your two restaurants.
I hope you will too.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you both for being on. Great. And everyone should not only stop by the restaurants, but check out this amazing copy of Kindness and Salt out now everywhere books are sold.
Awesome.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. A big thank you to our sponsor, MOFAD. That's the Museum of Food and Drink. Music by Cookies and Matt Patterson Engineering. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.